It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Don W. from Las Vegas.
Thanks, Al. My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. I might as well start lying right away. It's really good to be here. I'd like to thank Michael for asking me to come out tonight. That's two. I'd like to welcome the people who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not a lie, actually. Really want to welcome you here. There's nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that can hurt you. It may appear that way when you're going through it, and you may think this is worse than death, but the truth of the matter is that from my experience, alcoholism destroys lives and families, and Alcoholics Anonymous puts lives and families back together. I've seen it happen too many times. I've experienced it myself. I know it to be true. You can argue with my opinion all day if you want. I probably won't listen, but my experience won't go away. And that's what we do around here, is we talk about our experience. And my experience, I've been restless, irritable, and discontent since May the 19th of 1995. That was the first day I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. First day that I didn't have a drink for a 24-hour period in a long time that I can remember. And I've had periods of brief and fleeting serenity during that time. And I wish I could hold on to them. But the fact is that life happens, and sometimes I deal with it well, and sometimes I don't deal with it well. But I've learned how to practice here in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are a lot of people here tonight. It's really difficult for me to speak in front of a group of people I know, probably because they know the story and they know the truth, and I really don't want to tell the truth. I'm an intensely private person. I always have been. I became more private when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why that is, but I do know one thing. I had a sponsor that we used to travel all up and down the California coast and sometimes around the country, and he would speak at meetings like this, and we would spend time in this van, and the van was like hell, but anyway, because the problem with being in the van is that you can't get away, and I can't excuse myself to go to the bathroom when it gets a little rough. And he would tell me, always on the way there it was pretty vibrant, and on the way back it was pretty somber, and he would usually fall asleep. And I asked him one day, I said, why do you always fall asleep on the way back, you know? It's not like you did anything. You know, you stood up there, you told a couple of lies, you sat down, we go home. And he said, Don, he said, if you ever get the opportunity to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, what I've learned is that before I go and speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, I ask God to remove everything that stands between me and the people who are sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on that particular evening. Because I may have something to say, and I don't know what it is, that's going to help somebody in that room. And if I'm holding back, then they're not going to hear it. And I'm not going to get the benefit of helping somebody, and they're not going to get the benefit of hearing what I have to say. And he said, that's an exhausting experience. And you know what? I found it to be true. It's absolutely true, because when I come up here, before I came up here, I was in the bathroom. By the way, whoever's got the bathroom commitment needs to clean it, but that's okay. And I got down on my knees, and I asked God to remove everything that stands between me and the people that are sitting here in this room tonight, and to please use me as an instrument of His words. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, because somewhere along the line, I usually end up deciding that I have a better way and a better plan, and I divert it. But the fact is that when I do that, what seems to happen is it just seems to pour out. And when it just seems to pour out, at the end I'm exhausted. And that's just the way it is. So anyway, I want people who are new here or not necessarily new here to know that I am not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you guys, but when I first showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought all meetings were like the first meeting that I went to. First meeting I went to was on 3rd and Bonneville. In some church there, it was a midnight meeting. There was a guy there who wore tinfoil on his head to block the alien transmissions. I really liked him. Really liked him. He was really a sharp guy. He had a lot of good things to say. and agreed with me most of the time. And for that, I was eternally grateful, because most everybody else in that meeting was saying, dude, you're screwed up. You know, you're screwed up. But anyway, I showed up to this meeting, and I thought all meetings of alcohol, you know, all meetings are candlelight. All meetings are open discussion. All meetings, you know, have people in there that talk about, you know, their feelings and their therapist and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But the one thing I did get out of that meeting that is probably the most critical thing that anybody who's new in Alcoholics Anonymous can get from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is I got identification. I believe that I belong there. And the reason that I believe that I belong there is that the first night that I came to that meeting, I sat there and I tried to stay as far away from the candles as I could because I didn't want anybody to see me. Now you got to understand, the last couple years I was out there drinking, there wasn't a person on the face of the earth who wanted anything to do with me. Nor should they have wanted to, because I'd become a leech. I was a scumbag. And I sat there in this meeting, hoping against hope that nobody actually saw me. And this guy came his turn to share, and his name's Tom. And I'd never seen Tom before, and I've never seen him again. And what Tom did is Tom took his 5 minutes, and he looked me right in the eye, and he told me what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him. In a 5 minute period, he told me what he used to be like, what happened, and what he's like now. And at the end of it, as he was looking me directly in the eye, and I'm trying not to look at him, because you know how it is. I know how it is when I'm new. I don't want anybody to see me. And don't look in my eyes, because then you can really tell. All right? So he's looking me in the eye, and Tom says, and this can happen for you too. And I want you to know tonight that if you're new and your life's an absolute train wreck, and there's no way out, welcome. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is the way out. It's the way out. There's other ways out. They didn't work for me. I tried them. They didn't work for me. I guess I better tell you that I drank, because I am in an AA meeting, and I don't want you to think that I just came in off the street, because I was lonely. I was born and raised here in Las Vegas. Love Las Vegas. I didn't love Las Vegas when I was born and raised here. Las Vegas was a very small town. Everybody knew everybody. And my father I don't want to call him prominent, but maybe that's the right word, but he was a well-known person in Las Vegas. Yeah, he was a businessman. He took care of things for a lot of people in Vegas. He knew a lot of people. And thus, they knew me. And up until about age 13, that was pretty cool. But when I started drinking, it wasn't cool anymore. And my first drink was on the corner of Jones and Charleston at an arcade called Razzmatazz Arcade. And I can tell you on that night exactly what I was wearing. I can tell you where I walked. I can tell you what pinball machine I played. I can tell you the name of the girl that I lost my virginity to. I didn't lose it, I actually gave it up willingly. But alcohol's magical stuff, man. Magical stuff. And I can tell you that as I was sitting there on the steps of that arcade after hitting that bottle of Seagram 7, that was probably 5/8 of the way full, all right? When I hit that bottle about 3 or 4 times, something magical happened to me. And I'd like to tell you that night that, you know, that I became an alcoholic, but my trip into alcoholism was a very slow and painful process. The very next night, I went back to the same arcade. I wore the same shirt. I wore the same shorts. I wore the same pair of shoes. And I had that same bottle of Seagram 7. Now, my buddy, that first night, as we were walking back to the house, he had stole the bottle of Seagram 7 from his mother's liquor cabinet. And he had drank too much. And about halfway between the arcade and our house, there's a park. And he made it to the park, and he made it into the bathroom, and he started blowing chunks. And I'm laughing at him and stuff like that, you know, and, you know, because it was all funny to me. And then he did something that I absolutely did not understand. He started to pour that bottle of Seagram 7 into the toilet. It got serious right about that moment. I rescued the bottle of Seagram 7 with everything I had in me. I think he's still got the American Standard implant on his forehead from me getting to it. And something amazing happened to him from that moment on. He never drank again. He said, I don't like this stuff. This stuff makes me sick. I don't like the fact that I was out of control. I don't like the fact that I don't remember what happened. I don't like that. And I'm thinking, dude, you're messed up. This has been the best night of my life. I went back to that same arcade the next night with that same bottle of Seagram 7. And the thought came over me that if I drank twice as much, I would have twice as much fun. And that night I ended up throwing up on my shoes and passing out under a pinball machine. Now you could say that I crossed the invisible line into alcoholism at that very moment. But I really didn't become a true drunk until I left my parents' house. And I'm going to bore you with the details just because I can. And the thing is that if you're new here, and if you could learn from my experience, then I could give you everything that I learned from May the 19th of 1995 to today in probably about a month. But the problem with alcoholics is that most of the time, we don't learn from other people's experience. I got to try it myself. There is one time that I did learn from somebody else's experience. I'm going to tell this last drinking story and then I'll move on. But I somehow, through a series of events and circumstances that obviously weren't my fault, I ended up in the military. And I remember as I was on this bus going to the military thinking that this was a severe mistake and a severe misjudgment by some judges that thought that this would be good for me. And if I just wrote them a letter that I would be able to get out of this. But anyway, there was this guy in the military that I was with, and his name was Ferguson. Ferguson was from Ohio. Now, if there's anybody here from Ohio, I'm sorry. I really don't like people from Ohio. You know, I mean, yes, our program was started in Akron, and that's a wonderful thing. You know, Akron's kind of like Bethlehem. Something good happened there once, and that's enough. But anyway, Ferguson and I, you know, we were pretty close because we drank. And Ferguson liked to drink, and Ferguson could drink like nobody else. But Ferguson, I wasn't at the point yet where the phenomenon of craving hit me every time I drank. It would hit me in sporadic, but a lot of times at this point in my drinking, I could still taper off or stop at the end of the night. And Ferguson didn't have that. And Ferguson ended up getting to the point, I remember one night, we were on base, and if you're on base, there's really like some protocol that you need to follow there. You know, they don't really like a couple of things. And what Ferguson did was Ferguson decided that it would be a good idea to put his Budweiser boxers on his head and run around the base naked screaming, I'm a dying cockroach, I'm a dying cockroach at the top of his lungs. That tends to get people's attention. And he ended up in rehab. You know, like Gary was talking about, you know, they gave him, you know, you want 45 days in the brig or 45 days in rehab. And he said, I'll take the 45 days in rehab. Now, the military does rehab a little different than most places do. When he got out of rehab, he would have to show up at the CO's office every morning and have this little pill put underneath his tongue and show the CO that he had swallowed this pill. And this pill was called Anabuse. Anabuse is a wonderful drug. And what it does, if you don't know what, I don't even know if they may have outlawed it by now. I mean, they should. Because giving alcoholics Anabuse is just like giving them a death sentence. I mean, there ain't no way, if I don't have any recovery, that I'm going to stay sober. I'm either going to drink or I'm going to put a gun in my mouth. And Ferguson drank on Anabuse. And I remember watching him as he's trying to hold this booze down and he's breaking out in hives. And they told him, I mean, the reality of it is at very best, if you drink on Anabuse, at very best, you're going to get violently ill. That's the very best. The downside is you could die, okay? And Ferguson knew all this information, yet he still took a drink. And I remember sitting there thinking, you poor bastard. But the next thought that came to my mind is, I'm next, and I'm getting the hell out of the military because there ain't no way that I'm not drinking. And I knew that. And all throughout my life, if I look back, I can see that every decision that I made, up until coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, was to protect my right to drink. I got kicked out of the military to protect my right to drink. I got kicked out of college to protect my right to drink. I lost relationships. I lost jobs. I moved from city to city to protect my right to drink. If the decision came down to drinking or follow the rules, I'm drinking. See you later. If it looks like I'm getting smaller, it's because I'm leaving, okay? I'm out of here. And that was my MO. That was my MO. I had to tell you that went on for a long time, and I thought Gary did a great job. I don't want to pump him up too much because he'll get a big head. But I thought Gary did a great job about describing, you know, the imperceptibly slow trip down that alcoholism takes us to, into pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. For me, it was imperceptibly slow. I couldn't see it happening. And I would come to one morning, and you know, I mean, I started in an upper middle class family and I ended up in the ghetto. And it wasn't like one day I was in an upper middle class family, I took a drink, and the next day I was in the ghetto. There was this period of time that it took. And during that trip, I got comfortable with each step down the ladder. And by the time I ended up in the ghetto, you know what? Just like Gary was talking about, it was okay to be in the ghetto. Ghetto's not so bad. Ghetto's pretty cool. You know? Why spend $12 on a case of beer when you can get a case of red, white, and blue for 99 cents? Why? Doesn't make any sense to me. And anyway, one morning I was 27 years old, I came to, and it was just like any other day. It wasn't a special day by any means. I was broke. I was about to be homeless. The job, you know, I was on suspension pending investigation. I love that term because all that means is you're fired in a couple of days. We just don't want to see you until we get the paperwork together. That's what that means. See, I always like getting fired on the spot because the federal law says that they got to pay you. And I need to go drinking and I'm broke. So if I get fired now, then you're going to pay me so I can go drinking. And you know what? It's going to be fine. My mom was sick with terminal cancer. I weighed about 150 pounds. I weigh about 215, 220 today. That'll give you an idea of what I looked like. My hair was falling out. I was still cool, though. You know, I was still cool. Still had sunglasses. Still had the leather jacket. You know, living in Vegas, it's essential to have a leather jacket. And you know, I still had all those things. Had that alcoholic car. Alcoholic car had more epoxy cement on the radiator than radiator, you know, it was one of those. You know, it was like Old Faithful at the stoplight. And I remember stumbling into the bathroom and looking into the mirror and looking into my eyes. And I probably hadn't looked into my eyes for a couple of years, maybe 3 or 4 years at this point. I'd learned how to shave without looking, you know, because I didn't want to see what I'd become. I knew what I was. Deep down inside, I really knew. When it's really quiet at night, you know the alcoholic hour? If you haven't had the alcoholic hour, I hope it never happens to you. I really don't. I don't wish it on my worst enemy. But the alcoholic hour is like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. When I come to, and I'm sick, and I'm broke, and there ain't nothing left, and all the laughter's gone, and all the fun, and all I am is sick. And the reality hits me. That morning I came to, I stumbled into the bathroom. It might have been afternoon for all I know, but anyway, I stumbled into the bathroom, I looked into my eyes. Here's what I heard myself say. Don, it's all your own damn fault. Nobody did this to you. And for the first time in my life, I took responsibility for what I had become. Now, I didn't know it at the time. But at that very moment, as I looked into my eyes for that brief moment in time, I took the first half of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I admitted that it was my fault. You know what? Nobody ever held me down and poured a drink down my body. Nobody ever. As much as I'd like to blame it on you, my theme song, it's a very simple theme song, happiness is knowing who to blame. You know, I mean, that's what it's all about. If I can blame you for my problems, then I don't have to change. But when it becomes my fault, I have to change. And until I come to that realization that the life that I have created is mine and mine alone, now I can blame all sorts of things for it. I can blame the cop who wasn't getting a donut like he was supposed to, you know. I can blame my mom, you know. I can blame my uncle that touched my pee-pee when I was five. You know, I can do all of those things. But the fact of the matter is that until I come to that realization right in here that this is my life, this is what I've created, nothing will change. And the next thought that came to my mind was, what the hell are you going to do about it? And I didn't have an answer. I've always had an answer. I'm like the Shell answer man. You know, just ask me a question. I got the answer. I know what this is about. You know, and if I don't have the answer, what I'm going to do is I'm going to excuse myself to go to the restroom, and I'm going to come up with a good lie on the way there, and on the way back, I'm going to tell you, like I've got the answer. And you know what? At that moment in time, I didn't have the answer. At that moment, a thought came to me about a conversation that I had probably 15 or 16 years prior. My father got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 1 year old. I don't ever remember him drunk. I don't ever remember him coming home drunk. I don't remember any of that stuff. But when I was about 12 or 13, maybe even earlier than that, maybe I was 10, I remember my dad sitting me down and telling me this. He said, Don, he said, there are studies out there that suggest that alcoholism is a genetic disease. I said, okay, Dad. I knew he was an alcoholic. I'd been to the Thai club. I'd been to all these places, you know. I knew that he was an alcoholic. He said, son, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but you're showing all the signs. Now, at this point, I have never taken a drink. But my dad knew what alcoholism looked like. And what he did after that is he said, son, if your drinking ever gets to the point where it's out of control and you don't know what to do, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would suggest that you go there. And from that moment until the time I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, he never ever said another word about it. Never ever. And what he did was he stepped back and he watched his only son destroy his life over a period of time. Slowly, imperceptibly. I can't even imagine how hard that must have been for him. I can't even imagine. Because my dad's like me, private guy. And sometimes, if I was coherent enough and we were in the same room together, I'd catch that look in his eye of hopelessness and despair, knowing that his son's killing himself and there isn't a damn thing he can do about it. Because he knew the thing that we talk about here in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. He was too close. He was blood related. He was emotionally attached to me. He couldn't give me Alcoholics Anonymous the way you guys can give me Alcoholics Anonymous. He can't tell me the truth because he loves me. I can't imagine how hard that must have been. I've got a 3.5-year-old son today, and when I look into his eyes, I get a little bit more of an idea of what he must have felt like. Because I love that kid. I love him. I'd do nearly anything in the world for him, except leave Alcoholics Anonymous. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is what gave me the life I have today. For me, a guy like me, probably the worst thing that I can do, most selfish thing I can do in Alcoholics Anonymous or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous is leave. Because you guys have given me the best gifts that I've ever asked for in my life. You guys have given me a life that is unbelievable. It's worth staying sober for. The worst problem that I had when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, forget about the financial stuff, forget about the love, forget about all that stuff. The biggest problem that I had when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I could not get that cup, if it was full of coffee, from there to my lips without spilling it all over myself. I was a wreck. It was an absolute wreck. And anyway, so I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in that, you know, that $100 car that I had, and I drove it down to my dad's house, and I sat down on his couch, and I said, Dad, I don't know what's happening to me, but I do remember that you told me about this. And I said, Dad, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I really don't think I'm an alcoholic. Because I had preconceived ideas about what an alcoholic was. It's amazing how I can know absolutely nothing about something and yet have an opinion. I don't know where that comes from. And it's a valid opinion. It's right. And if you challenge my opinion, I will argue with you about it, even though you may be an expert in the field. Because you don't understand. And at that time, nobody understood. Nobody understood, man. Nobody knew what it was like to live in my shoes. And my dad told me, he said, son, there are open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like this is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody is welcome to come to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to be an alcoholic to come to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't know why you'd come, but you can come. And, you know, sometimes we see family members here to support other people. A home group I was part of, somehow they got a hold of our meeting time, and somebody that was involved with the university in the PhD program for chemical dependency, they used to have to come to our meeting once or twice or something like that and write a report about it. Now, you can imagine what that report must have been like. But anyway, I showed up, and that's how I showed up at that midnight meeting that I was telling you about earlier. That's how I showed up there. I didn't show up there because I thought I was an alcoholic. I showed up because I didn't have anything better to do. I really didn't have anything better to do. I'd tried everything that I could think of to make my life better, and I was an absolute and complete miserable failure at all of it. Everything that I'd tried, every plan, every idea that I'd tried to put into practice to make my life better made my life worse. And I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. I'd sit there and, you know, I remember sitting in that midnight meeting. Well, you can move. No, that doesn't work. You can get another girlfriend. No, that doesn't work. You know, you can do this. You can do that. Get a different job. You know, make more money. You know, get a new set of friends. I didn't have any friends, so a new set would have been better. But, you know, I mean, anything. And everything that I came across my mind, I'd either tried before or I was too chicken to try. And there was a guy at that meeting, his name was Mike. And Mike's still sober today. Mike lives in California somewhere. I always forget the name of the city, so I don't want, you guys can go look him up if you want. And but anyway, Mike, a little short guy, and fire plug. Found out later, you know, I remember sitting there in that meeting thinking, I can take him. 150 pounds soaking wet, I can take him. Found out later he was a judo champion. Glad I didn't try. And after the meeting, Mike came up to me. I'd probably been going there for a couple of weeks, and Mike said, hey, I've been seeing you come around. Now, up until that point, Mike had been saying hello, 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 hello. But at this point, you know, he came up and he said, hey, man, what's your story? Oh, you know, I got it going on. You know how it is, you know. Everything's great, you know. Life's great. He looked me in the eye and he said, shut up. You know, shut up. You ain't got nothing going on. You know, malnourished people that can't get the coffee cup from the table to their lips don't show up at a midnight meeting because they got it going on. You know, it just doesn't happen. And he says to me, hey, man, we're going to Denny's after the meeting. Do you want to come? What did I say? Sorry, man, I'm busy. You know, got things to do. Got places to go, got people to see. Once again, look me in the eye. I hate it when people look me in the eye. Oh, absolutely hated it at that time. Look me right in the eye. You ain't got nothing going on. It's 2:00 in the morning. All right? You ain't got nothing going on. I know you don't have anything going on. We went to this Denny's, the one over there by the Stratosphere. I like to call Denny's the Mecca of all sobriety, because that's where things like divide and conquer happen. For those of you who don't know what divide and conquer is, we walk into this Denny's, there's 5 or 6 of us. They ask for a table, take that booth over there. We walk up to the table, one of the guys steps back. Like an idiot, I slide into the middle of the table and they surround it. And it's over. It's over. Not leaving. First couple weeks I was sober, I couldn't eat. Now, if I'd needed a diet plan at that time, it would have been a good diet plan. I did not need a diet plan. I lived off of Diet Pepsi and cigarettes. And yeah, that'll take the pounds off. And they gave me a menu. And I'll never forget this. People who say the little things don't matter don't know guys like me. The little things matter a lot. And they gave me this menu. Now, when I was a kid, screw that. Anyway, they gave me this menu. And I opened up this menu, And I like to think of myself as a pretty intelligent guy. And I looked at this menu, and there were too many choices on the menu. I'm starving, absolutely starving. Got money in my pocket, you know? It's okay, I can pay for my meal. I know that. But there's too many choices on the menu. And I start to freak out. I got the menu up like this so they can't see me. And Mike leans over the table and puts his finger on top of the menu, pulls the menu down slowly, you know. He looks me in the eye. Hate people looking me in the eye. Do you want some pancakes? Yeah, I'd like some pancakes. Good, we'll get you some pancakes. And he slowly took the menu from me and folded it in half and set it aside. Now, he could have said what I probably would have said was, hey, moron, what do you want to eat? You know? The waitress has been by three times and we're hungry. But he didn't do that. He didn't embarrass me. He allowed me to have a little bit of dignity at that moment when I had absolutely none. I didn't deserve dignity. Didn't deserve it. And I remember we sat around that table, and as people started to talk, you know, I'm waiting for the Bible to come flying at me and, you know, all this stuff, because I got preconceived ideas about what Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know? I know what Alcoholics Anonymous is, don't you know? You know? My dad is sober in AA. My dad's experience doesn't mean a rat's ass, you know? My experience is what counts if I want to stay sober in AA. But at that time, you know, I wanted to hang my hat on that. And we talked about skateboarding, punk rock shows, and growing up in Vegas. And Mike had been, found out that Mike had been to the same punk rock shows that I'd been to. He ran in the same group that I did. I just didn't really recognize him. And well, another critical thing about Mike is Mike had these mutton chop sideburns. The mutton chop sideburns are very cool. And I had mutton chop sideburns as well, too. And on that very deep level, I asked him to be my sponsor. I know I don't have a ton of time here. I owe my life to a lot of people in this room. And, you know, there's some guys who I've run with through thick and thin that are in this room. And men in Alcoholics Anonymous, starting with Mike, have taught me to love another human being for what that human being is. And I didn't have that when I got here. I could care less about you. I really could. The only thing that I cared about was what I could get out of you. And then I would discard you like a piece of trash because I just didn't care. I had no regard for human life. I had no regard for your feelings. I can't imagine what my parents went through, you know? Because it really didn't matter if you were my mom or I met you 15 minutes ago. If you had something that I wanted, I was gonna do what I took to get it. What it took to get it, didn't matter what it was, and I was gonna do it. And you know what? It's like Gary was talking about, you know? Yeah, I feel guilt, remorse, and shame, but it's gotta happen. Sorry, you know, but I gotta go. And I stepped on people, and I walked over people, and where did it get me? It got me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And coming back from that, you know, I mean, people used to say wonderful things like, if you want to get out of the hole, throw away the shovel, you know. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and just because I walk through that door right there and show up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous does not mean that I am well. It does not mean that. I bring that same person into Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And that person does not go away overnight just because I want him to. You know? Just because I want those defects of character to go away, they don't go away. I gotta do some work. I gotta do some work around here. If I don't do some work around here, I'm screwed. I'm absolutely screwed. Because I walked through that door with a solution for alcoholism. It was killing me, but it still worked for brief moments at a time. Maybe 20 minutes, if I was lucky, and I was drinking. Now, I'd suffer as a result of that, but it seemed worth it to me because there was nothing else out there that was working. Nothing. Nothing. Mike helped me out a lot. I ended up, Mike ended up moving away. I ended up getting a sponsor named Mike Finch. Mike's passed away now. Mike had Lou Gehrig's disease. For those of you who don't know what Lou Gehrig's disease is, Lou Gehrig's disease is a disease that, it's a neurological disease. What happens is that your muscles atrophy to the point where you can't move, can't walk, can't talk. Strongest muscle in your body is the diaphragm. It's what allows you to pull air in and out of your body. Eventually that gets to the point where it doesn't work anymore and you suffocate and you die. And I remember when I met Mike, Mike walked with a limp and I thought, he's just milking it, you know, what a loser. And, you know, I'm trying to get some sympathy. And I found out later what was really going on. And Mike's that guy that I traveled up and down the coast with in that van. And that's where I really got Alcoholics Anonymous, in that van. In that van, we worked the steps in that van. We talked about life in that van. AA happened on the road for me. I had to show up for it. Because it's easy to show up to a meeting, sit in the chair, say the Lord's Prayer, bail. It's difficult when you're in the middle of a van with four or five other guys and they're asking you direct and pointed questions like, why did you do that, Don? And I don't have an answer. And I learned about life in that van. I learned how to be a husband in that van. The first thing that Mike had me do, because my first year and a half, 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't exactly smooth. You know? I was ready to put a gun in my mouth, stone cold sober, because I hadn't changed a bit. I was still that same scumbag. And all I did when I came into AA was I saw a new set of suckers. That's it. You know? And Mike, I remember the first thing Mike had me do was draw a line up down a piece of paper. This is not AA approved, so please don't do it. It might save your life. Draw a line down a piece of paper, write drunk on one side, write sober on the other. And he says, let me ask you a couple of questions. And he says, you can do this on your own. I don't want you to read it to me. This is for your own benefit. How'd you treat women drunk? How'd you treat women sober? What's your job experience like drunk? What's your job experience like sober? What's your relationship with your parents drunk? What's your relationship with your parents sober? I went through about 10 of those examples, and you know what I found out? The only difference was I wasn't drinking. Nothing had changed. I was still the same scumbag. And that's when my life started to change. That's when I took the second half of the first step. I'm a slow study. But when I realized that my life had become unmanageable, then the other 11 steps became absolutely critical to me being able to breathe in and out without it hurting. You know what I'm talking about. When it hurts to breathe, it's so damn painful just to put one foot in front of the other because my life's a train wreck, stone cold sober. That's when it's time to do something, you know? Anyway, I was dating this girl. We'll call her Benita, because that's her name. I'd met Benita through a set of circumstances that, you know, I can't really get into right now, but safe to say it was doing exactly what it says here on this flyer here. What does it say there? We must take actions that we don't believe in if we are to recover. And that's exactly what I was doing. I got a job. And I met her at work. And best woman I've ever dated in my entire life. And I'm trying to destroy the relationship. Don't know why. Picking arguments for no reason. Don't know why. Can't tell you why. Go to Mike finally. After I'm in enough pain, Mike, what the hell's going on here? You need to shut up. You need to shut up. You need to go over there and start being of service. That's what I did. That's what I did. I've got, you know, and as a result of simple things like being of service, what happened is that I started to see her for what she really is, and she wasn't there as a tool for me to use to fix myself. that she was a smart, intelligent, vibrant woman. She didn't need me, okay? I always pick women that were broken, you know? There was requirements. You either, if you were a woman and you wanted to date me, you either had to be unemployed or not have a car or, you know, homeless, you know? Three major requirements. Because then if you dated me, you needed me. You couldn't leave me, okay? Because you needed me. And Benita was the girl that didn't need me. And I knew that. I knew she was better than me. I knew she was. And I remember as Mike was taking his dying breath at 4.5 years sober, I had come to a realization that it was time for me to make an honest woman out of her, you know, to repay that love that she had so kindly given to me. And the best way I could think to do that was to ask her to marry me, but I was scared to death. And I remember going to Mike, and at this point he's in a hospice, and he can't breathe. And he's barely, you know, he's struggling to breathe, and I remember sitting, and he can't open his eyes. And, you know, Mike, I need your help one last time, buddy. And I leaned down next to him, and I said, Mike, I said, I really think that I want to ask Benita to marry me. But I need some help here. And I said, do you think it's a good idea? And he opened his eyes for a brief moment and he smiled. And the next day he died. Mike was like the brother I never had. And I got to tell you, I suffered a lot after he died. I suffered a lot. Not because he died, not because he left me, not because of any of that stuff, but because what I realized after he passed away, I didn't know this before he died, but I knew it the second that he did, was that I had learned how to love another human being unconditionally. I didn't need anything from Mike. I didn't want Mike to be, you know, I really didn't want Mike to like me, I didn't want Mike to love me, I just enjoyed him as a person. And I never had felt that before. I'm really, really lucky to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really lucky to be sober. I want you to remember this while I close. Life isn't fair, all right? It's not fair. If it was fair, I'd have about 45,000 volts shooting through my body right now, okay? Thank God I didn't get what I deserve out there. What I got is I got grace, and I got an opportunity to walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and put this fractured life back together with your help. And now, as a result, I get the opportunity to lead that life. I want to thank you for letting me share.